Now a ceremony in Britain that is hundreds of years old, the opening of Parliament.
Speaker, the Queen commands this Honourable House to attend Her Majesty immediately in the House of Peers.
Like Australia, the United Kingdom has two Houses of Parliament. Members of the British House of Commons, like our House of Representatives, are elected by popular vote. In May next year, Britain will hold a referendum to see if people want to change to a system which would allow smaller parties, like the Liberal Democrats, now part of the coalition government, more seats. The Liberal Democrats would also like to see changes in the upper house, the House of Lords, because unlike our Senate, membership of the House of Lords is only gained by inheritance or appointment, unless you happen to be a bishop of the Church of England. I'm Keri Phillips, and today on Rear Vision we'll look at the history of the House of Lords, in particular at how it has successfully survived attempts to reform and indeed abolish it by those who see it as an anachronism in a modern democracy. Philip Norton, Lord Norton of Louth, combines his role in the House of Lords with his job as Professor of Government at the University of Hull. He says that the origins of the House of Lords lie in the King's Council of the 15th century, which was made up of the landowning aristocracy of the day.
The House of Lords originates from the King's Council when the King was all-powerful. He had his advisers, particularly the leading churchmen, the leading landowners who became lords. And so over time, this became institutionalised as the King's Council, so the King sought advice from the Council. Now, this was supplemented in time by representatives or people drawn from the counties and from the towns. And they developed eventually as the House of Commons, eventually got two chambers, a body which spoke for the people, was drawn from the people, and one which wasn't, which sort of existed in its own right of members who were there in their own individual right. So that's how the two chambers came into being.
Dr. Meg Russell is reader in British and Comparative Politics at University College London.
There used to be many second chambers similar to the House of Lords. I mean, there have been hereditary and appointed chambers in other countries in Europe. Going, you know, if you go back hundreds of years, there are similar traditions in France, in Spain, in Italy, in Ireland, in Sweden. It used to be that the distinction between upper and lower chambers was, to a large extent, the distinction between upper and lower classes. This was phased out in other countries in Europe, but of course Britain has had, unlike other countries like France, Italy and Germany, has not had a revolution, has not been defeated in war, has never had to sit down and write a modern constitution. So the British constitution has gradually developed through small changes over time rather than being torn up and started again.
Over the centuries, although the power of the House of Commons grew, the House of Lords remained dominant until the first Parliament Act of 1911. Professor Andrew Gamble is head of the Department of Politics and International Studies at the University of Cambridge.
The House of Lords had a complete veto over the legislation, so it could block anything that the House of Commons brought up except for finance bills. That was the big exception. And that worked tolerably well, but as the franchise began to be extended, so the anachronism of having the landed aristocracy controlling one of the two Houses of Parliament became more and more objectionable to the to the rising democracy and to the Liberal Party in particular, until in the end there was a showdown at the beginning of the 20th century when the House of Lords actually did throw out a budget prepared by the Liberal Party under Lloyd George. And that created a constitutional crisis, the outcome of which was that legislation was pushed through which reduced the ability of the House of Lords to delay House of Commons bills, restricted it to 2 years. So they lost their absolute veto. And that was only achieved to overcome the absolute veto. The King had agreed that he would create enough Liberal peers to actually overrule the Conservative majority in the House of Lords, because it was traditionally dominated in the 19th century by the Conservatives, and that then continued in the 20th century. It continued to be dominated by the Conservatives, but they no longer had an absolute veto. They had the power of delay. But it still was a very useful adjunct to Conservatives to have basically control of the upper house. And they used to mobilise for big votes, and what were called the backwoods men, who used to come out from their estates and their shooting lodges and whatever, and come and vote against a piece of legislation which a radical government was trying to push through.
The Parliament Act was amended by a Labour government in 1949 to further limit the power of the House of Lords by reducing its right to delay bills from 2 years to one.
For many, many years, many decades since the late 19th century, there had been discussion about the rights and wrongs of having hereditary peers and how this was outdated and should be replaced with something new. Labour had not really cooperated historically with the House of Lords, and clearly hereditary peers were conventionally from the aristocracy, from the upper classes. Labour was very underrepresented in the House. The parties of the left had very little respect for it and wanted to abolish it. By the time it got to the middle of the 20th century, it was a House which had lost a good deal of respect, and the threat was that it would be abolished. The Labour Party in 1945 had a policy of abolition. Labour then did accept some hereditary peerages in the late 40s and 50s. They had to get people in there onto their benches to serve as ministers. They had a handful of people in there in the 1940s. It was vastly, overwhelmingly a Conservative House. But it was basically a matter of either reform or abolition. And it was the arrival of life peerages, which meant that a broader range of people could be brought into the House from a wider range of social backgrounds, representing all the political parties, that reawakened the House and saved it from oblivion, really.
Before the Life Peerages Act, the House of Lords was a fairly moribund body. It was a fairly large membership, but with a low attendance, because these are people who inherited their seats. They didn't necessarily wish to be in the Lords. So attendance was fairly small, under 100. It didn't meet that often. It would meet, but only for 2 or 3 hours in a day, then adjourn, not that many votes. So it really wasn't doing a great deal of work. The 1958 Life Peerages Act transformed that, as it was designed to do. So it brought in more members who were appointed in order to sit in the House and contribute to its work. So that affected attendance. You had more members, and not just that, you had more active members, i.e. they turned up, so you could start to develop committee work. So it started to shift from being a chamber-oriented institution. You start to get committees, and now committee work is a fundamental part of the House. The other big difference was the Life Peerages Act provided or encouraged a greater degree of the diversity of members. For one thing, the 58 Act allowed for women peers for the first time. So until then, wholly male chamber. And since then, a much more diversity in terms of background. The advantage of appointment is you can provide for a more diverse membership quicker than through the electoral process to the House of Commons.
The Life Peerages Act also allowed those on the left to feel more comfortable about accepting a title. A further change in the form of the Peerage Act of 1963 allowed hereditary peers to give up their titles.
Before that, it wasn't an option. If you were appointed a peer, it was hereditary, so you couldn't disclaim the title. The ability to disclaim the title only came in because Tony Benn, the Labour politician, he inherited a title from his father, but he desperately wanted to pursue a career in the Labour Party in the House of Commons. And so he unilaterally renounced his title and stood in a seat in Bristol and was elected and was then disqualified because he was a peer. And so then there was a by-election. He stood again and was re-elected and again disqualified. And this went, you know, I can't remember how many times this went on, but eventually it was recognised that this was an absurdity, that the electorate wanted somebody to be their representative who wanted to be their representative but was debarred from being so because he'd inherited a title which he hadn't sought. And so legislation was put through in the early 1960s to allow hereditary peers to disclaim their peerage.
Despite the fact that the Life Peerages Act allowed the Prime Minister of the day to choose new members for the House of Lords, appointments have tended to be relatively balanced along party lines and include those with no party affiliation. Given these are appointments for life, I wondered why members of the House of Lords bothered with party affiliation in the first place.
Maybe you have to remember that in Britain, political parties developed inside Parliament rather than developing outside Parliament. Parliament has been in existence in Britain since before there were political parties. Political parties formed inside both chambers of Parliament in order to support or oppose the monarch, and gradually developed into what are today's Conservative and Liberal parties, and then the Labour Party was formed outside to fight for representation for working people in Parliament. So parties developed in the House of Lords 200 or more years ago, and as time has gone on, it's morphed into a system whereby party leaders are responsible for picking who will go in. And in fact, nowadays, a lot of life peers are people who have spent time in the House of Commons as MPs. So a lot of them are very experienced senior politicians. When we have conventions that senior ministers are appointed, you'll probably know that former prime ministers have all been in until recently. John Major refused a peerage, and Tony Blair and Gordon Brown aren't there yet, but Baroness Thatcher continues to sit there, as do many people who served in her cabinets and the cabinets of John Major. And now we've seen an influx of people who served as ministers under Tony Blair. So it's not entirely a chamber of politicians, but you mustn't underestimate the extent to which it is a political chamber, as well as being a chamber of experts and so on.
It's important to stress there's a large section which is non-party. So in a house of well over 700 now, it's going to be approaching 800 members, well over 200 sit as what is known as crossbenchers. So those are peers without party affiliation. So it's recognised that that's an important element, that we need to have at least, you know, 20% of our members with no party affiliation. But others sit in party, because members are nominated on a party basis, sit in party groups. But there are two essential differences from the House of Commons. One is no party has a majority of seats in the House, and it's generally accepted that no party ever should. And the second is that although you sit in a party group, the party has no sanction in relation to your activity, because once you're a peer, you're there for life, you can't be got rid of, the party can't do anything about it. So, I mean, I suppose they could decide, well, you can't be a party member, or you can have the withdrawn, but that has no significant consequences. You're still a member of the House of Lords, you can carry on as before, you can carry on sitting exactly where you've always sat in the party group, you can't be forced to move. So in that sense, even though you sit with party, you are at the same time a free agent. So if you disagree with your own side, you can vote against and nothing will happen. So members are free to do that. So you do have a degree of independence. And the impact of party is lessened anyway, because members are usually here because of their particular expertise or the particular experience. So that lessens party influence. If a party says, well, our policy is A, and then the leading expert in the field covered by the policy stands up and says, well, policy A won't work for the following reasons. We tend to listen to the experts. So parties have got to listen to what goes on, ministers have got to listen, because the people getting to their feet and commenting are probably the leading specialists in the field, or people with great experience in that field.
This is Rear Vision with Keri Phillips on ABC Radio National. Today's program is about the British House of Lords and how it has survived despite attempts to reform and indeed abolish it. When the Queen announced a major reform of the House of Lords in 1998, the appointment of life peers made since 1958 had swelled the House to about 1,200 members.
A bill will be introduced to remove the right of hereditary peers to sit and vote in the House of Lords. It will be the first stage in a process of reform to make the House of Lords more democratic and representative. My government will publish a white paper setting out arrangements for a new system of appointments of life peers and establish a royal commission to review further changes and speedily to bring forward proposals for reform.
When Tony Blair's new Labour government passed the House of Lords Act, the absolute right of all hereditary peers to sit and vote in the House of Lords disappeared. In a compromise designed to get the legislation through the House of Lords, however, 92 hereditary peers would be allowed to remain until a consensus could be reached on further reform.
The absolutely bizarre feature to anyone outside Britain, and even within Britain it's considered pretty bizarre, I mean, a lot of people I don't think realise it, is that we now have a system where for these 100 or so places reserved for the hereditary peerage, when one of them dies or becomes incapacitated or whatever, there is a by-election to fill that vacant slot for a hereditary peer, and the electorate are the hereditary peers. and so you have the hereditary principle, the hereditary peers actually having an election of one of their hereditary peers. The great bulk now of the House of Lords, and it's the membership keeps fluctuating, but I think it's around 750, that sort of size. So this is a huge number. This is the largest second chamber in the world, as far as I'm aware. And so most of the others they're appointed, and so these are life peers, but they're appointed for life. And this used to be purely prime ministerial patronage. This has, because of the protests that this created, under Tony Blair, the term was Tony's cronies for the House of Lords, friends of Tony and safe votes for the Labour Party. But in fact, Tony Blair actually did give up a large amount of prime ministerial power over the appointments, and a special commission was set up, Appointments Commission, for the House of Lords.
There was a major change in 2000 with the creation of the House of Lords Appointments Commission. The House of Lords Appointments Commission is now responsible for choosing independent members to go into the House of Lords, and it is very much like applying for a job. If you go to the House of Lords Appointments Commission website, you can download an application form, you put in why you think you're an appropriate person to be a peer, they will shortlist, they interview people, and they pick who they think are the best people and appoint and recommend them to the Prime Minister, who recommends them to the Queen for appointment. The other thing that happened around about 1999-2000 was that the Prime Minister gave up power over picking who the people were to be appointed from other parties than his own. So now you have the Labour leader will pick who the Labour nominees are, the Conservative and Liberal Democrat leaders will pick the nominees for their parties, and the Appointments Commission picks the independent people according to a very open process.
So over the 20th century, both the power and the constitution of the House of Lords have changed enormously. It's gone from having the right of veto over government legislation to merely being able to send it back for reconsideration. And it's gone from being a house composed of aristocratic men with hereditary titles to one largely based on appointment. So what actually goes on in the House of Lords of the 21st century? Lord Norton.
4 days and sometimes 5 days a week, the House is sitting. Like the Commons, we start with question time. Ours is different. We go for depth rather than breadth, so it's limited number of questions in the time available. So we have quite a lot of time for each question. Question time, and then it'll be particularly Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, debating legislation. So the chamber is a debating arena, complemented by committees. We make use of what's known as Grand Committee for bills. They're so called because any member can attend the meeting of the committee. But we also use permanent investigative committees for policy areas. And we don't seek to duplicate the House of Commons, which has committees covering government departments. So we have committees that we see as cross-cutting issues, transcending departments. So we have committees on economic affairs, the constitution, communications, as well as dealing with particular aspects of legislation like delegated powers, statutory instruments. So we work through committees complementing the work of the chamber.
When the House of Lords is sitting and there are debates and so on, what's the temperature like? I mean, is it anything like the House of Commons during question time?
We tend to be very different from the Commons because the Commons is elected. That affects fundamentally the relationship between the parties. They're very competitive. So you get a high level of partisanship, particularly, of course, Prime Minister's question time, highly adversarial. You don't get that in the Lords because we're not elected, even though we may sit in party groups. election fundamentally changes the terms of trade between the parties. So in our case, we're not thinking in terms of election or re-election. So we're not opposing the other side because there are electoral competitors. So it's very different. And also because of the background of members, they're here because their experience, their expertise. Many may not have been involved in active political life in terms of fighting elections and anything like that. So they're here for other reasons. So it's far less partisan than the House of Commons. And members proceed on the basis that we are a house of experience and expertise. We therefore listen to the people who know what they're talking about. And that further lessens the impact of parties. The atmosphere is very different. Plus the fact what we're focusing upon tends not to be the highly controversial issues which resonate outside or get much attention. So we're just quietly getting on with rather detailed, extraordinarily important work, but not something that is going to set the world alight in terms of publicity.
Well, the issue of experts in the House of Lords is complex, like most things about the House of Lords. I mean, some people say that a lot of the expertise in the House of Lords is out of date because, of course, people enter for life. You're appointed when you're in a job or you've recently retired from a job, and then you may serve for another 20 or 30 years and your expertise becomes rather stale. Some people who are in there are trying to, and quite successfully maintaining some of them, jobs outside the House as, you know, living and working experts. So, you know, you've got working doctors, you've got working lawyers, you've got working scientists who are members of the House of Lords. This creates tensions as to, you know, should our legislators be full-time? A lot of the members treat it as a part-time job. They're not salaried, of course, so, you know, that's probably perfectly legitimate. These are some of the difficulties that you get into when you talk about election. You know, if you were moving to election, then you'd be moving to full-time people and that expert link would go and so on. So it's complicated. You ask, do they not already have bureaucrats advising them? Well, of course they do, but I suppose the difference between the House of Lords and the bureaucrats is the House of Lords is not just advising, it can actually trump ministers at times. You know, if sufficient of them get together, they can actually say, no, minister, I'm sorry, you can't have your bill in that form, you should have it like this.
People have described it as the best club in London. Their part of the Palace of Westminster is much more luxurious and grand than the House of Commons. And there are some very attractive restaurants and bars and tea rooms and lounges. Some of the Lords, of course, are very hard-working. And each party now has a number of what they call working peers. And the working peers are the people who are expected to attend debates and to speak in debates and to propose amendments and to propose changes that will improve the legislation and so on. So to take the revising function of the House of Lords seriously. So there is a core of people who do this work, and then there's a sort of wider group who can be drawn in for particular bills where they have particular expertise. And that does actually work quite effectively. So it isn't quite the cartoon version of the House of Lords which Gilbert and Sullivan satirised at the end of the 19th century. There's still an element of that, but there is also a kind of efficient core of it, which is why I guess it survived as long as it has.
Lord Norton believes that the House of Lords as it's constituted today works well, and that British voters don't mind an unelected elite sitting in judgment on the legislation of their elected government.
Well, we're used to a non-elected up house. And from our point of view, we see considerable value in that because we can complement the House of Commons by fulfilling tasks that are qualitatively distinctive by people who are not the same as MPs, who are drawn from backgrounds in science, the arts, humanities, whatever, to contribute from that perspective. Whereas MPs increasingly are career politicians. Now, if you elect a second chamber, the danger is it's just going to replicate the first chamber. It's another elected body, pretty much same type of person, and therefore duplicating the Commons rather than complementing it. Now, if you elect a second chamber, it'd be very difficult to sustain that relationship. The second chamber, even if you try and limit its powers, would be in a position to say we want more power, certainly more than the existing chamber. And that starts to inject, particularly if it's elected and therefore you get the party competition, more likely to get conflict with the first chamber. There are then all sorts of issues about on what basis would be elected, not just the system, but what body of electors would the members be representing. You could do it on a regional basis, some nationalist system, and how would you do it in a way that the members of the first chamber would not actually feel threatened by having somebody else speak for their constituents? And that's very important to stress, because if you're starting from scratch, setting up a new legislature, you might do it very differently. But when you're starting from an established system, then very different considerations come into play.
Is there any popular opposition or dissatisfaction, I guess, with the current situation? Does it concern people that there is an unelected upper house here?
Well, a number of MPs, particularly those who are opposed to electing a second chamber, do point out that the issue of an elected second chamber has never been raised on the doorstep in any election campaign. It's just not a salient political issue. It's what's known as an issue within the Westminster Village. So politicians, or some politicians, get exercised about it, and nobody else does.
Many people are concerned about that. I mean, House of Lords reform, I think it's fair to say House of Lords reform has not been off the political agenda since certainly the beginning of the 20th century. It's been debated regularly, and it's been very much on the agenda for the last 13, 14 years since Labour came to power. When you ask people what they want in opinion polls, they tend to say that they would prefer to have a largely or wholly elected second chamber. What the politicians fear, and I mean, Labour has had this ambiguous relationship with the House of Lords for all of its existence. Labour politicians have always been afraid that if you introduce too much democracy in the upper house, it's going to become hard for a Labour government to get its bills through. The House of Lords, because it isn't elected, has always exercised a good degree of restraint in challenging government. And what happens on the whole is that when government is proposing a policy which is genuinely questionable, where it's on weak ground in terms of making the argument, where perhaps public opinion is very sceptical about the policy, that's when the House of Lords will step in and dare to throw a bill back to the House of Commons and ask the government to think again. When the government's on strong ground, the House of Lords is not going to try for political reasons to block legislation just because it doesn't like it. It realises that as an unelected chamber, it needs to show restraint. So there's an interesting kind of balance in the system, which is it's not an unhealthy balance.
Possibly because the House of Lords is not a compelling political issue for most British voters, future reform remains unclear, although a round of indicative voting in the House of Commons in 2007 showed a clear preference for a fully elected upper house.
Well, we now have the coalition government of Conservative and Liberal Democrats, which has stated a very strong commitment to reform, and the Deputy Prime Minister, the leader of the Liberal Democrats in particular, is really keen to get on with House of Lords reform. But I think it's a lot more difficult than he realises. There were people on the Labour side over the last 13 years who wanted to push ahead with reform, and there are a lot of obstacles. The Liberal Democrats are pretty united in their desire for an elected House. They've got a grudge, basically, against the House of Lords that goes back to the blocking of Lloyd George's 1909 budget. It runs deep in the veins of the Liberal Democrats that the House of Lords is an anachronistic institution and needs to be democratised. The Labour Party has always had this ambiguous relationship with the House, fears making it stronger because it doesn't want to be too constrained when it gets into government. The Conservatives have an instinct to conserve and not to go for radical reform. So both Labour and Conservative parties are utterly split on the question of Lords reform. And Nick Clegg, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, may think he's going to push his reform through, but I think he's going to face difficulties with Conservative members of the House of Commons and certainly with Labour members of the House of Commons. I think he's going to have a lot of difficulty getting a reform bill through, no matter how determined he is, really.
Dr. Meg Russell from University College London. We also heard Professor Andrew Gamble from the University of Cambridge and Philip Norton, Lord Norton of Louth, who belongs to the Conservative Party in the House of Lords. The technical producer of Rear Vision today is Judy Rapley. I'm Keri Phillips.
You could regard it as a meadow into which you turn ancient horses to graze their last days, but on the whole, I would reply by saying that our debates are better debates than are heard in the House of Commons, and I can state as a fact, because it is a fact, that the Lord's Hansard, that is the report of our debates, sells more copies than the Commons Hansard.
We'll be right back. On the Law Report, a conversation with Chris Masters and Paul Barry on the perils of investigative journalism. Chris Masters tells of the toll that defamation disputes can have on even the toughest media professional, and why he came to fear a cold-blooded QC more than a gangster. And Paul Barry reveals his tips on how to deter potential litigants from pressing the litigation button. That's on the Law Report with me, Damien Carrick, and you can download or stream this program from the Radio National website.